Want to know the secret to great chowder or corn on the cob? Great corn. It's as simple as that. The trick is getting the corn. After that, it's a cakewalk. The first time I tasted really great corn, one of those early food memories that made me realize food was more than just fuel, was on a second-grade field trip to an upstate New York farm. Me and the farmer on a tractor, the farmer grabbing an ear of corn as he drove by the field, shucking it, and handing it to me to taste. In my head, I was thinking, "Holy Skeletor! I'd trade in my battle armor He-Man for more of this," which roughly translates to my current vocabulary as, "Holy F, this tastes amazing." My eloquence has diminished significantly through the years. Incredibly sweet, bright, and flavorful, it became the epitome of good corn in my mind, the corn that all corn since has tried to live up to, something that happens only rarely. Because of the result of a happy mutation several hundred years ago, sweet corn has a far higher concentration of sugar in its kernels than regular old field corn. That's the stuff they feed animals with. But here's the hitch. As soon as the ear leaves the stalk, that sugar begins converting to starch. Within a single day of harvest, an ear of corn will lose up to 50% of its sugar when left at room temperature. And even more, up to 90% when it's sitting out in the hot sun at the farmer's market. Moral of the story, buy your corn as fresh as possible, from the farmer if you can, refrigerate it as soon as you can, and cook it the day you buy it. Knife skills. How to prepare corn. When selecting corn, look for ears that are tightly shut, with bright green leaves that show no signs of wilting. Squeeze the ears, particularly around their tips, to ensure that the kernels inside are full and juicy. A good ear of corn should have very little give and feel heavy for its weight. Avoid ears of corn that have been pre-shucked or come packaged in plastic wrap. Any extra handling or packaging means that those ears are that much farther away from their original time of harvest. The best way to store corn is not at all. Don't buy it until the day you plan on eating it. If you must store it, keep it in its husks in the refrigerator's crisper drawer, but don't store it for more than a day, or you'll have starchy, flavorless corn on your hands. Instead, for longer-term storage, remove the kernels and then blanch them in boiling water for 1 minute, followed by a plunge into an ice water bath to chill them. Spread the blanched kernels out on a rimmed baking sheet and place in the freezer until fully frozen. Put the frozen kernels in a Ziploc freezer bag and store them in the freezer for up to 3 months. To remove the kernels from an ear of corn, first peel off the husk and silk and discard. Hold the cob in one hand and rest the end on the bottom of a large bowl. Hold your knife against the top of the ear, then cut downward, slicing the kernels as close to the cob as possible. They should fall neatly into the bowl. Repeat with the remaining kernels, rotating the cob as you go. Save the cobs if you want to extract their milk and make stock. Incorporating starches. Have you ever tried adding flour or cornstarch directly to a hot soup in an attempt to thicken it, only to find that the starch clumps up into frustratingly impossible-to-destroy little balls? Here's the problem, and it has to do with the nature of the interaction between starch, a complex carbohydrate found in all sorts of plant matter, including flour, and water. Remember those little dinosaur-shaped sponges you'd get as a kid, which you'd drop into water, then wait for them to grow? That's exactly what starch molecules are like. When dry, they are tiny and shriveled. They can flow freely past each other. But expose them to water, and they start growing, getting bigger and bigger, until they eventually rub up against each other and bind, creating a water-resistant barrier. Are you starting to get the picture? When a spoonful of flour or cornstarch lands on the surface of a pot of water or milk, the first parts to get wet are the starches on the outside of the granules, which rapidly expand, forming a waterproof seal. As you stir and submerge the clumps, a seal ends up forming around the entire clump, keeping the interior from getting wet. So, how do you solve this problem? two ways. With a starch that doesn't need to be cooked before it is incorporated, just as corn starch or potato starch, just dissolve the starch in a small amount of liquid to start. Starting with a smaller amount of liquid makes the mechanical stirring action of your spoon, fork, or whisk much more effective. Smaller amounts of liquid also get viscous more easily, making it simpler to bash up those pockets of dry starch. I use an equal volume of starch to liquid to start and stir it until homogeneous before adding the remaining liquid or adding it to the rest of the liquid. For starches that need to have their raw flavor cooked out of them, such as flour, start them in fat. Starch does not swell in fat, so by first combining flour with a fat like butter or oil and mixing it until homogeneous, you end up coating the individual starch granules, preventing them from swelling and sticking together when you first add the liquid. After you add it, the fat eventually melts away, so the starch is exposed and can be incorporated smoothly. This is the premise behind using a roux to thicken a soup or sauce. Finally, remember that for starches to thicken properly, they must be brought to a complete boil to reach their optimal swelling size. You'll notice a soup thicken dramatically as it goes from just plain hot to actually boiling. How to buy broccoli and cauliflower. Shopping for broccoli and cauliflower is pretty much the same, and, luckily, finding good specimens is not too difficult. These hardy members of the brassica family have a good shelf life and are firm enough that they don't bruise or break easily during storage and shipping. A head of broccoli should have tight florets that are an even dark green with greenish to purple buds. Cauliflower should be an even pale white. Yellow or brown spots should be avoided, though if they are minor, you can simply trim them off. Look to the leaves as well, which should be tight around the base and appear bright pale green. Once you get the broccoli or cauliflower home, keep it loosely wrapped in plastic or in a vegetable bag inside the crisper. It should stay good for at least a week. Once you've cut it into florets, it's best to use it as quickly as possible to prevent excess moisture loss, though florets can be stored in an airtight container or Ziploc plastic bag with a damp paper towel placed in it for up to 5 days. Working with mushrooms. When shopping for mushrooms of any sort, look for ones that don't have any soft or discolored spots on their caps, which can indicate decay. For mushrooms with gills, such as portobellos and shiitakes, examine the gills under the cap as well, as they'll often start to turn before the rest of the shroom. It's okay if the bottom of the stem is a little discolored, but it should not be overly dry, mushy, or starting to shred apart. As for dirt, it is no indication either way. Mushrooms grow in dirt, so it's inevitable you'll find some attached to them. Obviously, cleaner mushrooms are easier to work with, but a little dirt on the cap or clustered near the stem is no problem. Once you get the mushrooms home, store them in a plastic bag with the top left open or in a perforated plastic container in the vegetable drawer of your refrigerator. Fresh mushrooms should keep for 3 to 5 days under optimal conditions. Can I wash my shrooms? You've probably had folks tell you things like, mushrooms are basically living sponges. Don't get them wet or they'll get soggy and you'll never cook them right. Those same people will recommend that you clean mushrooms by brushing them with a special mushroom brush. Oh, please. Or maybe with a damp paper towel. No wonder people don't like mushrooms. They're a pain in the butt to clean. But is this level of fear really necessary? I tested out this theory by cooking a few batches of mushrooms side by side. One I cleaned meticulously with a damp paper towel. Another I cleaned under the tap and shook dry in a strainer. The last I cleaned under the tap and spun dry in a salad spinner. I weighed all the batches before cooking and found that, hey, what do you know? The washed, then drained mushrooms gained only about 2% of their weight in water, while the washed, then spun mushrooms gained about 1%. That's about 1.5 teaspoons of water per pound, which in turn translates to an extra 15 to 30 seconds of cooking time. So what does this mean? It means that most of the water you add by washing mushrooms clings only to the surface. So long as you dry your mushrooms carefully before cooking, you can rinse them as much as you'd like. Cooking the spin-dried mushrooms side by side with the paper-toweled mushrooms confirmed this. They both cooked at exactly the same rate. Pumpkin soup. Sometimes vegetables are so starchy on their own that no additional thickener or emulsifying agent is needed to create a creamy, ultra-smooth pureed soup. Sweet sugar pumpkin and squash are ideal candidates. You could make a pumpkin soup, just like the creamy broccoli soup, by simmering the cubed pumpkins in broth and pureeing the lot. But much, much tastier is to roast the pumpkin first. There's more than meets the eye to the process of roasting starchy vegetables like pumpkin, or, say, sweet potato. It's not just about softening. First off, roasting drives off some moisture, concentrating flavor. Second, there are enzymes naturally present in pumpkins, other squashes, and sweet potatoes that will aid in the conversion of starches to sugars, intensifying their sweetness. While this process will occur naturally over time, slow roasting hastens these reactions. Finally, as the pumpkin roasts, liquid escapes from inside of it, making its way to the surface and bringing along some dissolved sugars with it. As the liquid evaporates, the sugars are left on the exposed surfaces of the pumpkin, where they begin to caramelize. The process of caramelization not only creates sweeter sugars, it also produces hundreds of varying flavor compounds that add depth to the finished soup. I like to use a mix of pumpkins and squashes, splitting them, tossing them in olive oil, and then roasting them as slow as I have the patience for before scooping out their innards and pureeing them with stock and other flavorings. Two paths to French onion soup. What's French onion soup doing in a book of American food, you might ask? Here's the answer. My goal is to wean you off of those little packets of powdered brown stuff to show you that with science at your side, making real caramelized onions and French onion soup is not nearly as time-consuming or difficult as you think. There is certainly no shortage of recipes for French onion soup out there, and the general method begins with the same basic technique. Cook down finely sliced onions over low, low heat so their natural sugars slowly and evenly caramelize. Once the onions are completely broken down to a deep brown, jam-like consistency, just add stock, a splash of sherry, and a couple of aromatics. Simmer it down, season with a bit of salt and pepper, and serve with cheesy croutons. It's a simple process, and the results are infinitely better than any commercial version, but it's a major pain in the queue. All that slow caramelizing takes a good 3 to 4 hours of constant pot babysitting. Let it go just a bit too long or step away for 5 minutes, and you've burnt your onions, making the final product too bitter to use. As with exercise and marriage, I often think about how great it'd be if there were a method that could deliver the exact same or better results without the massive time commitment. The bad news? After several months, okay, years, of testing, and more than 50 pounds of onions later, I've discovered that there isn't really a perfect substitute for traditional caramelizing. The good news? You can get 90% of the way there in about 10% of the time. That's a pretty decent exchange rate. Here are the basics. Seeking sweetness. First, it's important to understand exactly what's going on when an onion browns. Sweating is the first stage of sautéing onions or other vegetables. As they slowly heat up, moisture from their interior, onions are roughly 75% water by weight, some other vegetables are even more watery, begins to evaporate, forcing its way out of the cells and causing them to rupture in the process. This breakdown of the cells is what causes vegetables to soften. Enzymatic reactions take place as the contents of the vegetable cells, a complex mix of sugars, proteins, and aromatic compounds, in the case of onions, mercaptans, disulfides, trisulfides, thiopenes, and other such long, no-reason-to-memorize chemicals are spilled out and begin to mix with each other. Caramelization begins to occur once most of the liquid has evaporated and the temperature of the onion starts creeping up into the 230 degree Fahrenheit and above zone. This reaction involves the oxidization of sugar, which breaks down and forms dozens of new compounds, adding color and depth of flavor to the onions. Sweetening of the onions also takes place. The large sugar molecule sucrose, aka white sugar, breaks down into the smaller monosaccharides glucose and fructose, the same two sugars that corn syrup is made of. Since one glucose molecule plus one fructose molecule is sweeter than a single sucrose molecule, the flavor of the caramelized sugars is actually sweeter than the sugar they started out as. The Maillard reaction, aka the Browning reaction, also takes place at these temperatures. This is the same reaction that causes browning on your toast or your steak when you cook it. The Maillard reaction is far more complex than caramelization, involving interactions among sugars, proteins, and enzymes. The products of the reaction number in the hundreds and are still not fully identified. In an ideal world, as the onions continue to cook, three things will happen at the same time. 1. The complete softening of the onion cell structures. 2. Maximum caramelization, that is, as brown as you can get before bitter products begin to develop. And 3. Maximum Maillard browning, with the same caveat as caramelization. By enhancing these results, I should be able to speed up my overall process. Mission 1. Increase the effects of caramelization. The most obvious way to speed up caramelization is to add more raw ingredients, namely sugar. The sugars in onions, as mentioned before, are glucose, fructose, and sucrose, a combination of one glucose and one fructose molecule. Exactly the same as the caramelization products of granulated sugar. So I tried cooking a touch of sugar in a dry skillet until it reached a deep golden brown, then adding the onions and tossing them to coat them in the hot caramel. It worked like a charm, shaving a good 4 to 5 minutes off my total cooking time and giving me sweeter, more deeply caramelized end results without affecting the overall flavor profile of the finished product. Mission 2. Increase the Maillard reaction. There are a number of things that affect the Maillard reaction, but the overriding factors are temperature and pH. At this point, I had no safe way to increase the temperature. Just like with a steak, if you cook the onions too hot, the edges and outsides of each piece begin to burn before the interiors have a chance to release their chemicals. Low and slow is the only way to go. On the other hand, I had a bit of control over the pH. In general, the higher the pH, that is, the more basic or alkaline, the faster the Maillard reaction takes place. The key is moderation. While large amounts of baking soda dramatically increased the browning rate by over 50%, any more than 1/4 teaspoon per pound of chopped onions proved to be too much. The metallic flavor of the baking soda took over. I also noticed that the baking powdered onions were much softer, not an undesirable trait for a soup. This is because pectin, the chemical glue that holds vegetable cells together, weakens at higher pH levels. Faster breakdown means faster release of chemicals, which means faster overall cooking. Mission 3. Increase the heat. Back to the heat. As I mentioned, the problem with increasing the heat too much higher than medium-low is that the onions begin to cook unevenly. Some bits and edges will start to blacken long before other bits reach even the golden-brown stage. Additionally, the sugars and proteins that get stuck to the bottom of the pot as the onions cook rapidly turn dark brown because of their direct contact. So the question is, if you're cooking with high heat, what can you do to simultaneously even out the cooking all across the onions, remove the sticky browned gunk from the bottom of the pan, and regulate the overall temperature so that nothing burns? If you've ever made a pan sauce, the answer is so blindingly simple that I'm surprised it's not a completely common practice. Just add water. At first, adding water may seem counterproductive. It cools down the onions and the pot, forcing you to expend valuable energy heating it up and evaporating it. But here's the deal. Both the browned patina on the bottom of the pot and the browned bits on the edges of the onions are made up of water-soluble sugar-based compounds that happen to be concentrated in a single area. Adding just a small amount of liquid to the pot at regular intervals means these compounds get dissolved and redistributed evenly throughout the onions and the pot. Even distribution leads to even cooking, which leads to no single part burning before the rest is cooked. So what does all this mean for your onions? It means that you can cook them over a much higher flame. Medium-high works well. Even maximum heat is feasible, though it requires a little more attention. And every time they threaten to start burning, just add a couple tablespoons of water and you're smooth sailing once again. As I said, the flavor is not quite as deep and sweet as traditionally slow-cooked onions. Sometimes there are simply no shortcuts to quality. But it's worlds better than anything you'll ever get out of a can, box, or packet. And it can go from start to finish and make it to the table in under 30 minutes. That's some seriously fast onion soup. All about onions. In the mood for some chili? You're going to need 3 cups of onions, medium dice. Making chicken stock? 2 onions, large chunks please. And what about onion soup? Yes, believe it or not, you'll need onions for that too. No matter how you slice them, onions are used in a good 30-40% of any cook's savory dish repertoire, if not more. They are the first thing you should learn how to cut when you pick up a knife, and, at least for me, still one of the most pleasurable foods to take a sharp blade to. What color onion should I be using? There are 4 basic onion varieties available in most supermarkets: yellow, white, sweet, Vidalia or Walla Walla, and red. You may also occasionally see Spanish onions, which are larger, milder relatives of yellow onions. Although sweet onions have about 25% more sugar than standard onions, their flavor difference when raw has more to do with the amount of tear-inducing lacrimators they contain. Yellow and white onions have more of these pungent compounds, but after cooking, they all but disappear. For the most part, onions can be used interchangeably without catastrophic consequences, unless you consider red onions on a slider to be a catastrophe. But some onions are better suited for certain tasks than others. Yellow onions are the kitchen workhorse. They boost a good balance of sweetness and savoriness, though they can be quite pungent and are best for cooked applications. If there is one onion you should never be without, this is it. White onions are extremely mild in flavor and have a distinct sweetness. When caramelized, they have a flat, one-dimensional flavor that can come across as cloying. They are best used raw or in soups. Sweet onions, Vidalia, Walla Walla, Maui, etc., cook similarly to yellow onions, but their mild pungency and sweetness are better enjoyed raw in preparations like chopped salads or fresh salsas or sliced for sandwiches. Red onions are rarely used for cooking, as their pigment can turn an unappetizing blue with prolonged cooking, throwing off the color of your finished dish. Slightly more pungent than white or sweet onions, red onions are best used raw or in simple, quick cooking applications, like on the grill or under the broiler. Shallots are the diminutive cousins of onions. They have a distinctly sweet and pungent flavor and are great both raw in salad dressing or cooked with other vegetables. Think of them more as onion seasoning than real onions, with the ability to provide onion flavor without overwhelming a dish. Does size matter? Ah, the eternal question. The size of an onion has little bearing on flavor, though I prefer larger onions because I have to peel fewer of them to get the same volume of prepped onions. How do I tell the good onions from the bad? No matter what type of onions you choose, make sure that they are firm to the touch when you buy them. If they give even a little bit, particularly at the root or stem end, there's a good chance some of the interior layers may have begun to rot. Where's the best place to store them? Store onions in a cool, dry, dark place, never in a sealed container, which can trap moisture, leading to mold and rot. I keep mine in a Chinese bamboo steamer. Half-used onions can be placed in a plastic bag in the refrigerator. Just use them within a few days. I've noticed that, like grandmothers and movie theaters, some onions smell more than others. Is there a way to know before I buy? How much an onion smells is largely dependent on how long it's been stored. The longer onions have been in storage, in some cases up to months, the more pungent they'll be. Unfortunately, it's not always easy to tell, as they don't come with a date on the label. Generally, older onions have thicker, tougher skins, while newer onions will have thinner, papery skins. But it's not like you have a choice anyway. Markets don't offer old onions and new onions. The unfortunate answer is that with onions, you've got to play the hand you're dealt. But we've got a few tricks for dealing with them in our arsenal. Listen on. What is it that makes onions smell anyway? My favorite Calvin and Hobbes strip is the one where Calvin walks into the kitchen and sees his mom crying while cutting an onion. He walks away mumbling, "It must be hard to cook when you anthropomorphize all your vegetables." Classic. But there's a very real reason we cry when onions are cut into. Defense. Onions take up sulfur from the soil as they grow, storing it within larger molecules in their cells. Separately, they store an enzyme that catalyzes a reaction that breaks these larger molecules down into pungent, irritating, sulfurous compounds. Only after the onion's cells are damaged by chopping or crushing do the precursors and enzymes mix, producing what are called lacrimators, compounds that attack nerves in our eyes and nose, causing us to tear up and sneeze. Nature at its most defensive. That's why an uncut onion will have very little aroma, but as soon as you slice it, the smell begins to permeate the room. Those lacrimators really get my tears flowing. Anything I can do to help it? There's no shortage of home remedies that are claimed to suppress or minimize tearing up. Light a fire supposedly catalyzes some reaction that prevents lacrimators from forming. It doesn't work unless you are cutting your onion directly over or under the flame. Rinse the onion as you go. Works okay, but wet hands and sharp knives don't mix. Place a piece of bread on the cutting board. Does absolutely nothing. Suck on an ice cube or chew a toothpick. I can't even begin to fathom the rationale. Chill the onions in ice water for 10 minutes first. This works pretty well. The cold slows down enzymatic reactions. But of all the cures, there's only one that's really effective. Just block your eyes. If you're a contact lens wearer, you've probably already noticed that onions don't really bother you. For the rest of you, ski goggles or swimming goggles are the way to go. Plus, they make you look really cool. Trust me. Is there any way to get rid of that onion odor? Let's say you happen to have some extra pungent onions. It happens to the best of us. Is there a way to tame them? I tried out a few different methods, from submerging them in cold water for times ranging from 10 minutes to 2 hours, to chilling them, to letting them air out on the counter. Soaking the sliced onions in a container of cold water just led to onion-scented liquid in the container, without much of a decrease in the aroma in the onions themselves. Perhaps if I'd used an unreasonably small amount of onion in an unreasonably large container, the water would have diluted it more efficiently. Air drying led to a milder aroma, but also to dried out onions and a papery texture. The best method turned out to be the fastest and easiest. Just rinse away all those extra pungent compounds under running water after you slice the onions. And not just that, but warm water. The speeds of chemical and physical reactions increase with temperature. Using warm water causes onions to release their volatile compounds faster, about 45 seconds is enough to rid even the most pungent onions of their kick. But doesn't hot water turn the texture of an onion limp? No. Even if you use very hot tap water, it generally comes out at around 140 degrees to 150 degrees Fahrenheit or so, while pectin, the main carbohydrate glue that holds plant cells together, doesn't break down until around 183 degrees Fahrenheit. There are other bits of the onion that, given enough time, will begin to soften at hot tap water temperatures, but it takes far longer than the 45-second rinse needed. Don't worry, your onions are safe. Classic French onion soup. What about those lazy Sundays when you don't mind hanging around the kitchen for the several hours it takes to caramelize onions properly? What's the ideal method then? Most recipes have you play the babysitter, cooking the onions slowly on the stovetop, stirring every few minutes. There are really two separate processes going on here. The onions are softening, releasing water and various dissolved sugars and other chemical compounds from inside their cells. Simultaneously, there's caramelization as those sugars are heated. Ideally, both of these things end up finishing at around the same time. But here's what I wondered. Could I divide the process into two distinct steps? First, letting the onions fully soften and release their juices, then reducing those juices and browning them? If so, I should be able to save myself a bit of babysitting time by limiting my stirring to the final stage of cooking. To do it, I went back to a method I'd learned from Chef Jason Bond for making a sweet white onion puree back when I was a line cook at No. 9 Park. All you have to do is to cook onions thinly sliced, pole to pole, they'll have a better texture when cooked, in butter in a heavy enameled cast iron or stainless steel Dutch oven. Once they get going, throw on the lid, turn the heat down as low as possible, and let them sit there. As the onions heat, they give off liquid, some of which turns to steam, recondenses on the roof of the pot, and then falls back down, keeping the onions moist as they soften. After a couple hours, with just one or two stirs in the middle, the onions will be completely softened and have given up all the liquid and dissolved flavor compounds they're gonna give up. At this stage, it's a simple matter of reducing that sugary liquid over moderate heat until it's deeply caramelized and brown, using the browning and deglazing process I use for my quick caramelized onions. The resultant soup is sweet, rich, and deeply complex. Chicken and dumplings. It's going to be tough not to stick a joke about my late pup Dumpling in here somewhere, but I'll try my best. Once you realize that chicken and dumplings is nothing more than chicken stock combined with biscuit dough, adding this dish to your repertoire is a snap. You learned how to make an awesome chicken stock in record time, and we explored the science of biscuits in our breakfast chapter. So the only question is, does a biscuit recipe need any modification to cook properly in the moist environment of a soup pot? The answer, unfortunately, is yes. But not much. Regular biscuit dough tends to be really high in fat, a full 4 ounces of butter for every 10 ounces of flour. The flour can't form tough gluten sheets as readily as it otherwise would because its proteins are lubricated by butter. In an oven, this is no problem. All you've got to do is get your biscuits on a baking sheet, and from there, don't touch them until they're baked and set. In the dynamic environment of a pot of soup, however, with bubbles simmering all around, condensation dripping from the ceiling, and pieces of chicken jostling it every which way, the delicate biscuit dough doesn't stand a chance. It's almost guaranteed to disintegrate, turning the broth sludgy and greasy. The first step to modifying biscuit dough for dumplings is to reduce the fat. I found that 6 tablespoons, down from 8, was a good compromise, still leaving plenty of flavor, but increasing stability. This introduced a new problem, though. With less fat, the dumplings were coming out a little dry and dense, tougher than they should have been. I tried increasing the amount of baking powder and baking soda, but neither one worked. the dumplings ended up with a strong chemical aftertaste. The easy solution? An egg. Each of the two parts of an egg improves a dumpling dough in its own way. The fatty, protein-rich yolk replaces some of the fat that was lost when I cut back on the butter. But, unlike butterfat, which starts melting and leaking out of the dumplings at around 90 degrees Fahrenheit, an egg yolk does the opposite, becoming firmer as it is heated. Emulsifying agents found in the yolk, like lecithin, also help ensure that the fat stays put inside the dumplings. The egg white, in this case, acts as a leavener. As the dumplings cook, their loose protein matrix begins to solidify, trapping bubbles of water, moist air, and carbon dioxide created by the baking powder and the baking soda buttermilk reaction. As the dumplings continue to cook, this moist air expands, resulting in lightness and tenderness. Pot roast. Give me a good American-style pot roast and all its dripping, savory, messy, beefy glory over a French bœuf bourguignon any day of the week. I love how the meat shreds under the slightest pressure from your fork. I love the rich onion-scented gravy, studded with flecks of beef debris. I love the tender carrots and potatoes, heavy with meat juices. For soul-satisfying cold-weather fare, it's about as good as it gets. Pot roast is essentially a large piece of braised meat. Braising is the act of slowly cooking a piece of meat in a moist environment. The moisture can come from submerging it in liquid, in which case it's technically called stewing, or by cooking it in a covered or partially covered vessel designed to trap moist air around the food. As the meat cooks at a low temperature in a moist environment, just as when making stock, the connective tissue, primarily made up of the protein collagen, slowly converts into gelatin. This is essential because cooking also transforms meat in another important way. It drives out moisture, even if you cook it in a completely moist environment. Indeed, because water is such a great conductor of heat, beef boiled in 212 degree Fahrenheit water will actually get hotter and lose moisture faster than beef roasted in a 212 degree Fahrenheit oven. But there are other reasons to keep liquid in your pot. First, it regulates the temperature so that there's no chance of anything ever getting hotter than the boiling point of water. Second, it facilitates the transfer of flavors among different parts of the meat and the vegetables. Finally, what good's a pot roast without gravy? All good meat recipes start with the right cut. For pot roast, any number of cuts high in connective tissue will do, but I prefer the chuck eye. It's beefy and has plenty of gelatin-rich connective tissue to keep it moist. After browning the roast in a Dutch oven, I further bolster the flavor by adding a mirepoix of carrots, celery, and onion, browning them in the same pot. The moisture exuding from the vegetables will help deglaze the fond left behind by the browned beef. Time for the umami bombs. Anchovies, marmite, and soy make their way into pretty much every braised dish I make for their savory glutamates. While French-style braises may resort to rich, reduced veal stocks to thicken the gravy, flour is the thickener of choice stateside. Next up, a bottle of wine. It's not especially traditional in an American pot roast, but, just like anchovies, marmite, and soy sauce, wine is rich in savory glutamates, adding meatiness to the broth as well as complex aroma and hint of acidity. Some chicken stock, a few peppercorns, and some sprigs of thyme and bay leaves round out my flavor profile. After building my braising liquid, I put the beef back in, place a lid on the pot, and set it in a 275 degree Fahrenheit oven to cook until tender, making sure to leave the lid slightly cracked. Why, you may ask? Temperature regulation. With a completely sealed lid, the water inside the pot rapidly reaches the boiling point, a temperature at which, given time, over 50% of the moisture in a piece of beef will be forced out. By keeping the lid ajar, you can keep the contents of the pot at around 185 degrees Fahrenheit, even in a 275 degree Fahrenheit oven. This lower temperature allows the collagen to slowly break down while still maintaining a good level of moisture inside the meat. Constant heat versus constant temperature. You may wonder why many braised recipes call for cooking in the oven instead of simmering on the stovetop. Here's the deal. A stovetop maintains a constant heat output, while an oven maintains a constant temperature. This means that on the stovetop, the same amount of heat energy is being transferred to the pot, no matter how much stuff is inside it, and no matter how hot that stuff already is. A pot of stew that's barely simmering at the start of cooking over medium-low heat might be at a rapid boil toward the end of cooking, when some of the liquid has evaporated and the volume of the stew has diminished. In an oven, no matter how much or how little food there is in the pot, the temperature of the food remains the same. Moreover, an oven heats gently from all sides, while a burner focuses the heat on the bottom of the pot. Move all your braises to the oven, and you'll get better results. Guaranteed. When I made the pot roast, after about 3 hours, the meat was at just the point I wanted it, tender enough that a knife or cake tester could slip in and out of it easily, but not so tender that it had lost its structure. The broth, by the way, smelled awesome. The problems arose when I tried to slice the meat. While hot, it was so tender that it was nearly an impossible task. It shredded and fell apart even with the sharpest knife and the gentlest touch. The best way to slice braised meat is to allow it to first cool completely. Originally, I thought it'd be best to allow the meat to cool down in the air of the kitchen instead of in the hot liquid inside the pot. But I tested identical halves of the same roast cooled in the air versus in the liquid, and here's what I found, which is located in the bonus material as retained weight versus cooling method. As you can see, the meat cooled in the liquid ended up with a good 3% more moisture than the one cooled in the air. This is because cooler meat can hold moisture more easily than hot meat. So, as the meat cools in the liquid, some of the liquid is reabsorbed. I also found that then allowing the pot roast to rest in the refrigerator for up to 5 days actually improved both flavor and texture, which means that for the ideal pot roast experience, you ought to cook the thing several days before you plan to eat it. Stewing beef. The best cuts of beef for stewing or braising have plenty of robust beefy flavor and lots of connective tissue to break down into rich gelatin. Here are a few of my favorites. Chuck comes from the shoulder of the steer and is intensely beefy, with a good deal of fat. The best chuck cuts for braising are the seven bone and the chuck roll. I prefer the latter, which is a boneless cut that makes for easier slicing. Look for well-marbled pieces with a nice cylindrical shape for even cooking. Brisket comes from the steer's chest. A whole brisket contains two parts, the flat, also called thin cut or lean, and the point, also called deck or moist. The flat is more commonly available in supermarkets, but if you can find the point, it's worth buying for its larger amount of connective tissue, fat, and flavor. Brisket is not quite as rich as chuck and has a distinctive metallic, grassy aroma. Flap meat, also known as sirloin tip, is generally sold as an inexpensive steak, but it's great stewed, which makes it one of the most versatile steaks around. A whole flap steak is a rectangular block of meat about 1.5 inches thick, weighing about 2 to 3 pounds, with a very strong grain and plenty of fat. It has a deep, beefy flavor and a robust, ropey texture that holds up well to long cooking. Round comes from the rear leg and is available as many different cuts. Bottom round, with a flavor similar to chuck, is the best for braising, though its odd shape makes it a bit harder to handle. Eye of round is by far the leanest of all the braising cuts, and so has a tendency to dry out a bit. If you keep a careful eye on the temperature and make sure to remove it from the oven as soon as it is tender, it does make a decent lower-fat option. But where's the fun in that? Short ribs are technically part of the chuck, but are sold separately. They come in three forms, as hunks of meat on top of 6-inch sections of rib bones, called English-cut short ribs, as pieces of meat attached to 3 to 4 rib bone cross-sections, flank and cut, and boneless. All three make great stew meat. Their abundant fat and connective tissue ensure that they'll be meltingly tender and rich when properly cooked. Experiment. Boiling water under cover. Does leaving the lid on or off really make much of a difference when cooking in an oven that's supposed to be maintaining a constant low temperature? Try this quick experiment to see for yourself. Materials: 2 identical pots filled halfway with water, 1 lid, an instant read thermometer. Procedure: preheat the oven to 275 degrees Fahrenheit. Place both pots in it, one with the lid on and the other with the lid off. Let the water heat for 1 hour, then open the oven and immediately take the temperature of each pot of water. Results: the water in the lidded pot should be at around 210 degrees Fahrenheit, while the water in the uncovered pot is probably closer to 185 to 190 degrees Fahrenheit. Because of the cooling effect of evaporation, it takes a significant amount of energy for those water molecules to jump from the surface of the liquid, energy that they steal from the liquid itself, cooling it down. An open pot of stew in a 275 degree Fahrenheit oven will max out at around 185 degrees Fahrenheit. Good news for you, because that's right in the optimal sub-simmer stewing temperature zone. Pop the lid on, and you cut down on the amount of evaporation. Less evaporation means a higher max temperature. In my simple test, putting the lid on increased the temperature in the pot by almost 25 degrees. Glutamates, inosinates, and the umami bombs. For many years, food scientists believed that our tongues were sensitive to 4 different basic tastes: sweetness, saltiness, sourness, and bitterness. Turns out that there's a 5th, umami. First discovered in Japan, it's best translated as savory. It's the saliva-inducing qualities that, say, a good steak or a hunk of Parmesan cheese has in your mouth. Just as the sensation of sweetness is triggered by sugar, saltiness by salt, sourness by acid, and bitterness by a number of mildly poisonous classes of chemical, umami flavor is triggered by glutamates, essential amino acids found in many protein-rich foods. The key to getting many dishes to taste meatier, turkey burgers, chili, stew, soups, etc., is to increase their level of glutamates. Now, you can do this with powdered monosodium glutamate, a natural salt extracted from giant sea kelp. But some folks are squeamish about using it. I personally keep a little jar of it right next to my salt cellar. However, there are alternatives, namely what I like to call the 3 umami bombs: Marmite, soy sauce, and anchovies. If you've ever been to England, you've probably seen Marmite. It's that strange dark brown goo with a sharp, salty, savory flavor that the Brits like to spread on toast in the morning. On toast, it's an acquired taste to be sure, but there's a lot of potential hiding in that little bottle. Made from a byproduct of alcohol production, it's essentially concentrated yeast proteins, rich in both salt and glutamates. Soy sauce is made from fermented soybeans and acquires high levels of glutamates from both the amino acid-rich soybeans themselves and the yeast and bacteria used to ferment them into the savory sauce. Anchovies and many other small oily fish are naturally rich in glutamates, and salting and aging them increases their concentration. Even many traditional recipes for rich meat-based stews will call for a few anchovies to help boost the dish's savory qualities. There are many other ingredients that have high levels of glutamates: Worcestershire sauce, Parmigiano-Reggiano, powdered dashi, a Japanese broth made with sea kelp and bonito, to name a few. But they all have pretty strong flavor profiles. My 3 umami bombs are the only ones I know of that can increase meatiness while blending into the background, making the natural flavors of meat stronger without imposing their own will on the dish. But which one to use? I made several batches of turkey burgers, incorporating the ingredients directly into the grind. Turns out that adding all 3 together is exponentially more potent in triggering our meatiness detectors than using any one on its own. Why does the combination work better than just one? Well, glutamates are the kings of meatiness, but there's a second chemical, disodium inosinate, that has been found to work in synergy with glutamic acid to increase the savoriness of food. In fact, in the August 2006 issue of the Journal of Food Science, researcher Shizuko Yamaguchi found that the synergistic effect of the two compounds is in fact quantifiable. So, combine the two and you get a synergistic effect, making each more powerful than if used on its own. Think of inosinates as the Robin to glutamate's Batman. They aren't necessary for the job, but they sure help an awful lot. By curing pork and fish, say, into prosciutto and Thai fish sauce, you can create super-concentrated sources of inosinates. Anchovies actually have quite high levels of inosinate, more than they need to balance out their own levels of glutamate, while Marmite and soy don't have much at all. Combining the inosinate in the anchovies with the glutamate in the soy and Marmite makes for the ultimate combination. Glutamate content in common ingredients. Many foods that we cook with every day are high in glutamates. Here's information about their relative glutamate content. Kombu, giant sea kelp, 22,000 milligrams per 100 grams. Parmigiano Reggiano, 12,000 milligrams. Bonito, 2,850 milligrams. Sardines, anchovies, 2,800 milligrams. Tomato juice, 2,600 milligrams. Tomatoes, 1,400 milligrams. Pork, 1,220 milligrams. Beef, 1,070 milligrams. Chicken, 760 milligrams. Mushrooms, 670 milligrams. Soybeans, 660 milligrams. Carrots, 330 milligrams. Skillet braised chicken. Quite a few other things may be as delicious as braised chicken legs, but few things braise faster or easier. So, more often than not, when I'm in the mood for tender, moist, stewed meat, chicken it is. I rarely braise chicken using the same recipe twice, but there are some common themes in all of them. The key to really great braised chicken is in the browning. You've got to brown the skin in the skillet until it's deeply golden brown and extraordinarily crisp. Then make sure that the skin remains above the level of the liquid the entire time it's cooking so that the crispness remains. What you end up with is fall-off-the-bone tender meat, deeply flavored with sauce and the crisp skin of a perfectly roasted chicken. You definitely want to use dark meat for this. It has more connective tissue, which slowly breaks down into gelatin as the chicken braises, lubricating the meat and adding some nice richness to the sauce. White meat will just dry out. One of my favorite recipes uses a splash of white wine, a can of tomatoes, a handful of chopped capers and olives, and a good sprinkle of cilantro. If I'm in the mood, I substitute smoked paprika for the regular kind and sautéed peppers and onions for the tomatoes, omit the capers and olives, and finish it off with parsley and a splash of vinegar. Equally good is a version with more white wine, a couple cups of chicken stock, and plenty of parsley and pancetta. Yet another variation incorporates mushrooms, shallots, and slab bacon. Again, it's the technique that matters. The flavors are up to you. These braises are even better flavor-wise the second or third day, though you do lose some of the crispness in the chicken skin. In search of the ultimate chili. Despite its Mexican origins, today's chili is a decidedly American dish. Even so, like a religion, the world of chili lovers is split into numerous factions, many of whom are prepared to fight to the death over what can and can't be used in real chili. Should it be made with ground beef or chunks? Are tomatoes allowed? Should we even mention beans? Since no one is going to agree on all of these factors, we're going to deal with not one, but two variations on beef chili. One a traditional Texas style, made with nothing but beef and chilies, and the other type most of us grew up on, with beans and tomatoes, including both a version made with short ribs and one made with ground beef. Either way, there are a number of things we can all agree on about a good chili. It should have a rich, complex flavor that combines sweet, bitter, hot, fresh, and fruity elements in balance. It should have a robust, meaty, beefy flavor. If it contains beans, The beans should be tender, creamy, and intact. It should be bound together by a thick, deep red sauce. To achieve these goals, I decided to break down chili into its distinct elements, the chilies, the beef, the beans, and the flavorings, and perfect each one before putting them all together in one big happy pot. The chilies. I have bad memories of my chili-eating college days, when chili was made by adding a can of beans and a can of tomatoes to ground beef, then adding one of every spice on the rack, and too much cumin, and simmering it. The finished product inevitably had a totally unbalanced flavor, with a powdery, gritty mouthfeel from all the dried spices. Bottled chili powder is fine in a pinch, but to get the ultimate chili, my first plan of action was to ditch the powdered spices and pre-mixed chili powders and go straight to the source, real dried chilies. Dried either in the sun, over a smoky fire, in the case of smoked chilies like chipotles, or, more commonly these days, in humidity and wind-controlled rooms, dried chilies have remarkably complex flavors. Just like meat that is aged, as a chili dries, it loses moisture, concentrating its flavorful compounds inside each cell. These compounds come into closer contact with each other, allowing them to react and produce new flavors that weren't present in the fresh pepper. Dried chilies are available in a baffling array, so to make my selection easier, I decided to taste every variety of whole chili I could find, taking note of both its spice level and its flavor profile. I noticed that most of them fell into one of four distinct categories: sweet and fresh, hot, rich and fruity, or smoky. For my taste, a combination of chilies from the first three categories produced the most balanced mix. The smoky chilies tend to overpower other flavors. Even though chilies are dried, their flavor can dissipate with time, so it's important to get fresh, dried chilies. They should have a leathery quality and still be flexible. If a chili splits or cracks when you bend it, move along to a different one. Dried chilies should be stored in a sealed container away from the light. I keep mine in Ziploc bags in the pantry and used within about 6 months of purchase. As with dried spices, the flavor of chilies can be enhanced by toasting them dry. This accomplishes two goals. First, the heat catalyzes reactions among individual compounds within the chili, creating new flavors. Second, the Maillard-Browning reaction takes place, resulting in hundreds of highly flavorful new compounds. After toasting, I could go the traditional route and simply combine the chilies and grind them into a powder, but I'm not one to bow to tradition. Instead, I found that by cooking them down in chicken stock and pureeing the moist chilies, I could create a completely grit-free paste for a concentrated flavor base for my chili. The best part? If I made a double or triple batch, I could freeze the puree in ice cube trays for long-term storage, giving me the convenience of jarred chili powder, but vastly better texture and flavor. The meat. Aside from beans, the meat is the biggest source of contention among chili lovers. Some, like my lovely wife, insist on ground beef, while others, like me, prefer larger stew-like chunks. More often than not, I begrudgingly let my wife have her way, which is why this time I was determined to fight for my own rights, or, at the very least, make her compromise her chili convictions. After trying store-ground beef, home-ground beef, beef cut into 1-inch chunks, and beef roughly chopped by hand or in a food processor into a textured mix of 1/8 to 1/2-inch pieces, it was apparent that the last one was the winner. It provided little bits of nearly ground beef that added body and helped keep the chili and my marriage well-bound while still providing enough large, chunkier pieces to give textural interest. There are plenty of beef cuts that are great for stewing, but for my chili, I decided to go with robust, beefy short rib. As anyone who's ever cooked ground beef knows, it's nearly impossible to properly brown a large pot of it. It's a simple matter of surface area to volume ratio. Ground beef has tons of surface area that liquid and fat can escape from. As soon as you start cooking it, liquid begins pooling in the bottom of the pot, submerging the meat and leaving it to gurgle and stew in its own gray-brown juices, which self-regulate its temperature to 212 degrees Fahrenheit, far too low for flavorful browning to take place. Only after its juices have completely evaporated can any browning action occur. the sad truth? With ground, or in our case, finely chopped beef, you have to settle for either dry, gritty meat or no browned flavor. But then I had a thought. Why was I bothering trying to brown the beef after I chopped it? If browned flavor in the stew was what I was after, did it even matter when I browned the beef, as long as it ended up getting browned? I grabbed another batch of short ribs, this time searing them in a hot pan before removing the meat from the bone and chopping it to size. The result? Chili with chopped beef texture, but deeply browned flavor. Yippee-ki-yay! The beans. If you're like me and believe beans are as integral to a great bowl of chili as the beef, if not more so, listen on. To be honest, there's nothing wrong with using canned beans in chili. They are uniformly cooked, hold their shape well, and here the relative lack of flavor compared to cooked dried beans is not an issue. There are enough other flavors going on to compensate. But sometimes the urge to crack some culinary skulls and the desire for some food science myth-busting is so strong that I can't resist. So, a quick diversion into the land of dried beans. If you have worked for a chef or have a grandmother from Tuscany or a mother-in-law from South America, you may have at one point been never told to add salt to your beans until they were completely cooked, lest you prevent their tough skins from softening fully. In fact, in some restaurants I worked in, it was thought that overcooked beans could actually be saved by salting them after cooking. To think! But how often have you actually cooked two batches of beans side by side, one soaked and cooked in salted water, and the other soaked and cooked in plain water? Chances are, never. And now you'll never have to. I present to you the results of just such a test. Both batches of beans were cooked just until they were fully softened, with none of the papery toughness of undercooked skins, about 2 hours for both batches, after an overnight soak. The unsalted beans ended up absorbing too much water and blowing out long before their skins had properly softened, while the salted beans remained fully intact. The problem? Magnesium and calcium, two ions found in bean skins that act kind of like buttresses, supporting the skin's cell structure and keeping them firm. If you soak beans in salted water overnight, though, some of the sodium ions end up playing musical chairs with the calcium and magnesium, leaving you with skins that soften at the same rate as the beans' interiors. The thing that does affect the cooking rate of beans is the pH level. Acidic environments tend to cause beans to seize up, which is why, for example, Boston baked beans, cooked in acidic molasses and tomato, can take as long as overnight to soften properly. Brining the beans in salt water mitigates this effect to some degree, but the only way to be sure that your beans will cook properly in acidic stews, like, say, chili, is to soften them separately and add them to the pot later on. So, where does the old anti-salting myth come from? Probably the same place most culinary myths come from: grandmothers, aunts, and chefs. Never trusted them, never will. The flavorings. The chili standard duo of cumin and coriander was a given, as were a couple of cloves. Their medicinal, mouth-numbing quality is a perfect balance for the spicy heat of the chilies, much as numbing Sichuan peppers can play off chilies in the Chinese flavor combination known as mala, numb hot. I also decided to give star anise a try, in a nod to British chef Heston Blumenthal and his treatment of bolognese sauce. He found that, in moderation, star anise can boost the flavor of browned meats without making its presence known. He was right, as I quickly discovered. For maximum flavor, make sure to toast your spices whole before grinding them. All I needed now was the traditional combo of onion, garlic, and oregano, along with some fresh chilies for added heat and freshness, and tomatoes. I simmered everything together, added my cooked beans, simmered again, seasoned, and tasted. So how'd it taste? Great, but not quite worthy of its best title yet. It could still do with some more meatiness. It was time to reach into my bat utility belt of culinary tricks for one weapon that has yet to fail me: my umami bombs, Marmite, soy sauce, and anchovies. These can increase the meatiness of nearly any dish involving ground meat or of stews. Adding a dab of each to my chili puree boosted my already beefy short ribs to the farthest reaches of meatiness, a realm where seared skinless cows traipse across hills of ground beef, darting in and out of fields of skirt steak, stopping only to take sips of rivers overflowing with thick glass de viande. I snapped out of my reverie with one thing on my mind: booze. Alcohol has a lower boiling point than water, and, even more important, it can actually cause water to evaporate at a lower temperature. You see, water molecules are held loosely together like tiny magnets. When water and alcohol are mixed, each individual water molecule becomes farther away from the other water molecules, making it much easier for it to escape and vaporize. Since water and alcohol-soluble aromatic molecules can only be detected by your nose if they escape into the air, it stands to reason that the more evaporation occurred, the more aromatic my chili would be. I added a shot of liquor to my finished chili and gave it a side-by-side sniff test with a boozeless batch. No doubt about it, the alcohol improved its aromatic properties. After a thorough tasting of vodka, scotch, bourbon, and tequila, in the name of good science, I came to the conclusion that in chili, they're all good. Whole versus ground spices. You often hear chefs and recipe writers saying to use whole spices instead of ground and to toast your spices before using them, but you don't often hear about why. To figure out the answer, I made 5 batches of my easy weeknight ground beef chili using spices and chilies treated the following ways: 1. Pre-ground, straight from the jar; 2. Pre-ground, toasted before adding; 3. Whole spices and dried chilies, ground and used without toasting; 4. Whole spices and dried chilies, ground and then toasted; 5. Whole spices, toasted and then ground. Every batch of chili made with whole spices and chilies, including those that weren't toasted, was superior in flavor to those made with pre-ground spices. Of the 2 made with pre-ground spices, the toasted version was slightly more complex, and of the 3 made with whole spices, the one with spices that were toasted before grinding was markedly superior to the one that used ground and then toasted spices. Why was this? Well, toasting whole spices accomplishes 2 goals. First, it forces aromatic compound-laden oils from deep within individual cells to the surface of the spice